The State of the Union is, so last week. But how's the state of the states? And which governors are looking at the White House for 2016? From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 14 of The Political Junkie. We have, as the stars on our flag tell us, 50 states, and many of them have governors who presented their state of the state messages in the past few weeks. So how are they doing? The Washington Post's Reed Wilson is here with a scorecard. And Congressman Henry Waxman announced his retirement last week, marking the end of the Watergate class of 1974. We'll talk to Michigan Democrat Bob Carr, one of those Watergate babies, about the significance of that era. And later in the podcast, a tribute to Joan Mondale. The wife of former Vice President Walter Mondale, Joan Mondale died this week at the age of 83. We'll be talking to a member of the Mondale family about the Second Lady's legacy. But first, a trivia question. We're going to focus on how the economy is affecting more than half the country's governors seeking re-election this year later in the show. So what state has the longest one-party rule for governors? Send your answer to Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. In return, you'll send us a picture of you sporting your button for the Political Junkie Wall of Shame on Facebook. Again, that's Ken at KenRudinPolitics.com. Last week's trivia question was, when was the last time a team from west of the Mississippi River won the Super Bowl the same year as a president born west of the Mississippi was elected? The answer, 1996. The Dallas Cowboys won the Super Bowl, and Bill Clinton of Hope, Arkansas, won a second term. And the randomly chosen winner is Eric Van Hove of Alexandria, Virginia. Eric gets that fabulous button. And that last scuttle button puzzle? One button read, LBJ, please stay. Then there was a button showing a dove back from the days of the Vietnam War. Then there was one from former Kentucky Senator Dee Huddleston. And then there was one that read, Massachusetts AFL-CIO, obviously a union button. So when you add them up, stay dove D union, well, you get State of the Union. And the winner is Melissa Flaherty of St. Louis, Missouri. You can keep up with the latest Scuttle Button puzzles, trivia, and my weekly columns at KenRudinPolitics.com. There's been so much focus on the battle for control of Congress, but you should know there are also elections for governor in 36 states this year. Many governors, like Jerry Brown in California and Andrew Cuomo in New York, probably have nothing to worry about. Others may be in for the fight of their lives. Reed Wilson covers state policy and politics for The Washington Post. Reed, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Not too long ago, the political climate looked pretty bleak for many of these governors who are up for re-election this year. But an improving economy helps their chances. Which states are bouncing back?
Well, we're seeing improved economic numbers pretty much across the board. Just about every state in the union has seen its unemployment rates drop, has seen a lot of new jobs created, and that's helping governors who are running for re-election this year. I'll give you a couple of examples. In Ohio, Governor John Kasich saw his approval ratings fall down into the mid-30s in the first year or so after he was elected in 2010. But then, as the economy has recovered and repaired a little bit, his numbers have come back up, and now we're seeing him leading his Democratic opponent by a pretty fairly significant margin. Michigan is the same way. Michigan once had the worst economy in America, the highest unemployment rate as the auto industry struggled, but since it has come back, we've seen the unemployment rate fall. It's still pretty high, but it has fallen, and hundreds of thousands of new jobs have been created. Tens of thousands of jobs have been created in Wisconsin, where Scott Walker was a vulnerable incumbent. Now he looks like he's stabilized, and his poll numbers are back up to good enough shape. Not great shape, but good enough shape. So across the country, we're really seeing Republican governors taking advantage of the fact that the economy is coming back.
That leads to this question. I mean, who gets the credit for the change in the economy? Yeah. If you're the Republican governor, you say it's your policies that brought job growth and lower unemployment. But if you're the Democratic challenger, you could say, well, it's more about what President Obama has done. I mean, who's right?
Yeah, that's the good question, and frankly, nobody is. Neither side is really right. President Obama's stimulus package certainly helped the economy come back a little bit, but it hasn't been perfect, and I think the administration would acknowledge that as well. These governors who have been in office just for a couple of years haven't had the time to see their policies really marinate. I'll give you another example. In Florida, Governor Rick Scott came into office with the unemployment rate around about 10.4%. While he was running, though, the unemployment rate began dropping from about 11.5% down to 10.4% even before he took office. So even though Rick Scott will try to claim credit for having built up that particular sort of economic comeback, it really began before he took office.
Both John Kasich of Ohio and Scott Walker of Wisconsin are mentioned as potential presidential candidates in 2016. Yeah. Obviously, an improving economy can't hurt their cause.
Absolutely not. And I think both candidates are often overlooked. The Republican Party is a party looking for a governor to nominate. A colleague of mine was out in Iowa at an event where Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee back in 2012, spoke. And as Ryan spoke, the governor of Iowa, Terry Branstad, of course, one of the gatekeepers of the crucial early state, was talking to the media and extolling the virtues of Paul Ryan and then said, boy, we need to nominate a governor in 2016. So, you can talk about Chris Christie in New Jersey, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. Kasich and Walker, I think, are the two guys elected in 2010 who are seriously going to be in the conversation in going forward in 2016.
What happens in a state like Pennsylvania where the economy is improving, but Governor Tom Corbett is still in big, big trouble? I think his problems may be less about the economy and more about him.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing this in a number of different states. It's not only in Pennsylvania, but also in Maine, where Governor Paul LePage is in some serious trouble, and in Florida, where Rick Scott, again, faces a difficult challenge from the former governor, former Republican, now a Democrat, Charlie Crist. And by the way, I'd throw President Obama in there, too. The economy is getting measurably better despite the last couple of weeks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is way up since he took office, and yet his approval rating are still low. He obviously isn't going to be on the ballot again, but for Corbett and Scott and LePage, they're not getting the same boost that some of their colleagues have gotten. I think there's a disconnect there among voters between sort of how the larger macros of an economic recovery and voters is sort of below the 1%, if you will, who aren't necessarily feeling that recovery in their own daily lives.
If the economy is improving everywhere, then obviously Democratic governors are being helped as well. John Hickenlooper in Colorado, for example.
Hickenlooper's approval ratings are back up to about 50%. He had a very rough political year last year. A number of recall elections went through after Democrats pushed through some pretty aggressive legislation on gun control and gay rights. We've seen, though, in other states, I was just out in California, and Governor Jerry Brown there, once thought to be potentially vulnerable, not the most popular guy, even among his own state party, and yet now the surplus in California is being measured in the billions of dollars. This is a state that had to cut and cut and cut over years during the Great Recession. Now they've got so much money that the big debate among the California legislature is how to spend new money. So across the country, it's not just Democrats, it's not just Republicans. Take a look at somebody like Pat Quinn, Democratic governor of Illinois, whose poll numbers have been terrible basically since the moment he took office. Now he doesn't look as bad as he has looked in the past. So across the country, we're seeing governors make comebacks because, in some cases, somebody else did something about their economy.
A lot of these states have governors who obviously are being helped by the improvement in the economy, but there's still long-term problems that these states face.
There are. Take a look at California. I think California is the prototype for some of these problems. Jerry Brown has been negotiating with a federal court for a very long time over what to do about the state's prison overcrowding, for example. The state is going to have to spend tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, building new prisons, housing prisoners in private facilities. Things like that can take a huge chunk out of a state's budget. There are two sort of separate problems that governors in various regions are going to face. In the Northeast, as the country gets older, you're going to see states having to spend a lot more on things like long-term care, providing infrastructure for seniors as their states get older. You know, the average age in a state like Vermont or New Hampshire or Maine is somewhere around the, you know, 42, 43 years old. On the other hand, a governor like Gary Herbert in Utah has a constituency where the average age is something like 26 and a half years old. I mean, that's a huge difference between some of these northeastern states. That 26 and a half year average age means that Utah is going to have to deal with serious growth over the next couple of years. Even as they're beginning to debate sort of how to go forward on things like education reform, Utah has to spend an additional $70 million on top of their education budget every single year just to keep pace with the growing population of school kids. So these states face very widely different problems. But of course, you know, all these big budget surpluses that they have now, the money's going to get spent somehow.
Reed Wilson writes the Washington Post GovBeat blog. He can be found on Twitter at PostReed. Reed, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Ken.
Coming up next, remembering the Watergate House class of 1974. Stick around. It's time for This Day in Political History. We keep hearing the Republican Party is split into factions between its conservative establishment wing and its anti-establishment very conservative wing. The GOP had similar splits in 1996. The establishment back then was Bob Dole, the Senate Majority Leader and a moderate conservative. And yes, he did win the nomination and fairly easily. But for a while, things were not looking good for the Kansas senator, and much of the blame could be placed on commentator Patrick Buchanan. 18 years ago today, Buchanan started off the battle for the White House with a surprise victory in Louisiana against Texas Senator Phil Gramm.
My friends, the Battle of the Bayou is over, and it has ended in a great triumph for the Buchanan Brigades.
Not long after, Buchanan rode that victory to a close second-place finish in the Iowa caucuses. He came within just 3 percentage points of Dole, where Dole was supposed to be an overwhelming favorite. Then, 5 days later, an even more shocking result. Buchanan beat Dole in New Hampshire. Pat Buchanan joined us today from his home in Virginia. Pat, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. Delighted to be here.
Well, you know, nobody thought you would come close in Iowa, and certainly nobody thought you would win in New Hampshire. How did that happen?
Well, it was a strategy we had devised, and we had a field of 8 or 10 candidates. And what we did is I decided that Iowa and New Hampshire are traditionally first, but instead we found a caucus up in Alaska. And I made 2 trips up there, and we beat Forbes' money machine by about 100 votes.
Steve Forbes, the publisher.
Steve Forbes, right. He was in the race and had a tremendous amount of money, and we beat him up there. And then I headed for Louisiana, and we had gone into Louisiana after all the other candidates said they would stay out and leave it to Phil Gramm, because Iowans did not want any caucus before Iowa, and they said they would punish anyone who went in. So we ignored the threat, waited for the others to drop out, and then challenged Gramm, who made a terrible mistake. He said he's going to win all 21 delegates, and he's going to win a landslide down there. It was a lock. So we figured all we had to do was win, say, 6 delegates and come within 15 points or 20 points. And I went down there and campaigned for a full week. And Gramm left it to his people down there. He had a tremendous organization, the state organization. But the grassroots came out extraordinarily. And we won that something like 55 to 35 on the night they counted the votes. It pulled the plug on Gramm in Iowa. His support collapsed. And his support moved tremendously rapidly to me a week later. And it brought me to where I was up at 23% to Dole's 26%.
Pat, before we even get beyond Louisiana, you did start off by mentioning Alaska. There was this woman who was not yet the mayor of Wasilla who was supporting you.
Yeah, I remember this very attractive lady came into a a meeting in Wasilla. And I am sure it was Sarah Palin. We had had a meeting and campaigned there. We campaigned on the Kenai Peninsula. We campaigned in Sitka, going up that coast where they have the bridge to nowhere. I can remember, Ken, waking up in some hotel somewhere in Iowa and picking up the phone. It was pitch black. And my sister said, "You won Alaska."
Back then, they used to say that you really weren't running to win the nomination. You wanted to give a message. It was for a cause. Were you running to be the nominee?
Well, I was running in 96, clearly, to be the nominee. You know, I beat out you know, Pete Wilson and Senator Lugar and Senator Graham and
Lamar Alexander.
Forbes and Lamar Alexander, governor of Tennessee and a U.S. senator. And we were clearly competitive with Bob Dole, and Dole was going to have a challenger running through the primaries, and he was not an extremely strong candidate. He started off above 50%, but he was dropping steadily. So I think I could have beaten Dole for the nomination. I do not believe I could have beaten Clinton absent some intervention. But if people talk about conveying a message, that was more the case in 92 when I challenged George H.W. Bush.
Moving ahead back to 1996, did you weaken Bob Dole for his contest against Clinton, or was he a weak candidate to begin with?
I think Bob Dole started off, I mean, overwhelmingly the favorite. He was above 50%. He was not as high as Hillary, who's at 70% now, but he was above 50%. But the more he ran out there, the more the party wanted something fresh, something new. If you take the votes of, I think Graham was clearly a conservative challenger, and Forbes and Buchanan and Keyes and Dornan, and you put them up against the votes of Dole and Lamar Alexander and Lugar and the others, I mean, the conservative side, if you consider Dole the establishment candidate, clearly was strong enough to win that nomination. It didn't go in as the favorite, but it was strong enough, given what we were able to do in Alaska and Louisiana and in Iowa against Bob Dole and in New Hampshire. I would have been able, I think, to take the nomination away. I'm not saying I surely would if I'd won Arizona.
Do you see any similarities between your battle against the establishment in 1996 and, I guess, in 1992, for that matter, against President Bush, and what's going on today?
Well, there's no comparison with 92. The comparison with 92, Buchanan and President of the United States, would be, and I've urged it a couple times on television, if I were a 40-year-old Democratic senator with a new, fresh agenda and ideas that were against the tired Democratic Party, I would challenge Hillary Clinton, run a very positive campaign, but on ideas. That's more like what I did in 92. But 96, there is a similarity among the Republicans with this exception. This field is far more even starting off than ours was. I mean, Dole, as I said, was above 50%, and we really had to bring him down. I was out there for a year in Iowa. You don't want to do that, Ken. I think 96 is similar to the Republican race in 2016, 20 years later, in this sense. Its strongest candidates like Rand Paul and Jeb Bush and Christie now, although he's fading, they're in the teens, like 14, 15, 16%, all of them. That is really as fair a race, as evenly matched as the beginning. It's a slow track, a slow field, and any one of these individuals, I think, could win it.
Well, it was on this day in 1996 when Pat Buchanan opened up that year's presidential cycle with a victory in Louisiana and shocked the Republican Party establishment. Pat Buchanan, thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted, Ken.
Last week, Henry Waxman announced he wouldn't seek another term in Congress. The Los Angeles Democrat was first elected to the House in 1974, one of 75 Democratic Watergate babies who were elected to Congress that November, much of which was in response to the Watergate scandal. The two remaining Democrats who have been in the House ever since are now leaving, Waxman and fellow Californian George Miller. The current House, of course, is under Republican rule thanks to the Tea Party victories of 2010. That was hardly the case in 1974. After that year's elections, Democrats held 291 House seats to just 144 for the Republicans, and it led to a very activist and liberal House of Representatives. Bob Carr was part of that class of 74. A Michigan Democrat, he served 6 years until being swept out in the Reagan landslide of 1980. Then he won the seat back 2 years later and remained in the House until he decided to run for the Senate in 1994. Congressman, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Nice to be here.
Describe the political situation in the country as it was heading towards the 1974 elections. How did Watergate change politics?
Well, I think Watergate was mainly a trigger. The events of the corruption inside the Nixon administration was only a trigger. There were a lot of negatives for the Republicans. It was the wave was coming, and I think we hit the crest of the wave with the massive public reaction against the Watergate corruption.
291 seats in the House. I mean, that's an enormous majority. What did the Democrats accomplish?
for many, many years before we got there, there was a movement to try to reform the internal operation of the Congress. And we came along at, right at the right time and supplied a lot of votes. So we had enormous reforms passed. We kicked out the rigid seniority system. We could get rid of some of the people who weren't very responsive to the caucus. We did a lot of things. I'd say my proudest moment personally was in March of that year, we ended the war in Vietnam with a resolution that I offered before the Democratic caucus.
When you were campaigning in 1974, you called for a comprehensive national health insurance program. You were ahead of your time.
I know. Well, and there were more before me that were touting that. So I was very proud. The only time I've really missed being in Congress was the day that passed. I saw my old friend and former colleague John Dingell, who had for decades, literally decades, has been arguing for national health insurance, was at the signing ceremony. That was the only day I've missed being in Congress.
There were some well-known names who were elected to that House class, Tim Worth, Chris Dodd, Paul Simon, Tom Harkin, Max Baucus. Anyone in particular stand out for you?
No, I think, you know, you're reeling off the names of those who went to the Senate, but you've just mentioned Henry Waxman. I mean, here's a giant of a legislator, even though he is a small person. He is a giant legislator, and he has proven with his career that you can accomplish and do many, many, many things as an ordinary rank-and-file member of the House of Representatives.
1974 was in the middle of that 40-year block of solid Democratic control of the House. It didn't end until 1994. What was the relationship between the two parties in 74 compared to what's going on now?
Oh, it was much more congenial. We really got along with each other. We socialized. We brought our families to Washington. We were on PTA boards meetings and school soccer games together, a lot of socializing. And we pretty much kept the back and forth, the partisanship, to the House floor. And occasionally there would be people who were dyed-in-the-wool types that would be partisan all the time, but
on both sides.
But most of the time, you know, I have to say that we really sort of looked at the policy, and we looked at our constituencies, and we looked at our districts and our states, and we tried to hammer out the best policy. And we knew that there was a open season just before the election, of course, but we closed ranks pretty tightly after that. And I think that has a lot to do with the leadership. Bob Michael, Minority Leader Rhodes, these were people who...
John Rhodes of Arizona.
Exactly. You know, a Tom Foley, a Carl Albert when I first came.
Tip.
Were very congenial to the opposition leaders, and it never got personal. Now, the Republicans like to say that Jim Wright was more partisan and use that as an excuse for Newt Gingrich being more partisan and things spinning out of control. But today, you have people who are leaders of committees, for example, the ranking and the chair of a committee, and their staffs won't even talk to one another. They grudgingly even acknowledge them in the hallway. It's just very, very toxic.
Back in the day, I don't know if this is part of it, but back in the day, many of the districts were like 53% Democrat or 53% Republican. They were not solidly D or R's back then.
Exactly.
So you had to woo voters on the other side.
Exactly. My district was a Republican district, marginally Republican, but
I... Republican since the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah, sure. And I won the support of Republicans. I had to get Republican support and independent support. So it had a mediating influence on how I approached my job.
You were young. I guess we all were young, but 1974, you were young. Would you recommend young people running for Congress in this climate today?
Yes, I would. And you know, that's against the odds of the money that you have to raise. I know that there are a lot of people who are just going to sit on the sidelines because the money chase has just gotten so difficult. But I think we're at the edge of something new, Ken. I really would predict that within the next 10 years, I think we're going to see new kinds of crowdsourcing for funding and support and campaigns that we haven't seen before. And I think that some of these super PACs and some of that other big money interests might just get shifted and pushed aside.
Bob Carr served 9 terms in the House representing Central Michigan, starting with his election in 1974. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Ken.
Before we go, a sad note. Joan Mondale died on Monday. She was the wife of former Vice President Walter Mondale. She was 83 years old. Joan Mondale accompanied her husband through many campaigns, for Attorney General in the Senate in Minnesota, for Vice President in 1976 and 1980, and during his challenge to President Reagan in 1984. But above all, her relationship with Fritz Mondale was a love story. In 2010, Minnesota Public Radio did a touching piece about their love affair.
The couple married after just 7 dates. That was more than 50 years ago.
1955? But we not only met, we got engaged and got married in the same time. That was very romantic.
Lucy Mondale is their niece, and she says that Joan was far more than simply a political wife. Lucy Mondale, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about Joan Mondale. I mean, we know she loved the arts, and she was known as Joan of Art. I love that. What does that mean?
Joan was known for her tireless and consistent devotion to the arts. She grew up with an uncle who was a curator at a museum in Philadelphia, and he kind of inspired the love of arts. And she never lost a passion for the art, but also an interest in sharing art with the masses. Joan really felt, and I thought this was best summarized, when she was quoted for an article in Japan. She was there with Fritz when he was ambassador to Japan. She had helped negotiate a deal where she got McDonald's to pay to hang art in a subway station in Tokyo. There was a quote from her in which she said something about, by putting art in a something as common as a subway station, you're saying that the people who walk through it are valuable. And I think that really embodied her appreciation. She brought art into everything she did early on in Fritz's political career. She wrote a book for children called Politics in Art. So she, having been thrust into politics, found a way to link art with politics, and she went on, she had a slideshow that she delivered for years and a presentation on politics and art. She could give it with her eyes closed. She did it so many times.
She loved the arts. She also loved Fritz Mondale. She often said that when she met him, it was love at first sight. It sounds like it was just a very loving and strong marriage.
It was a very loving and very strong marriage. They married very shortly after they met, some 59 years ago, I believe. The love endured through many, many years of politics, Attorney General of Minnesota, Senate, Vice Presidency, a presidential run. All of those are not easy on a relationship or a family. But as Fritz told me actually recently, he said she never complained, and she didn't. She really brought her grace and her class to every aspect of her life.
You know, I'm just going to say that. I was listening to as you were saying it. You think Fritz Mondale losing 49 states to Ronald Reagan in 1984, obviously that couldn't have been a happy time for the Mondales, but I've never, ever seen a photograph of her without her trademark smile.
That's right. She just didn't complain, and she was a minister's daughter. I think that kind of shaped her outlook on life, which was, you know, when something happens, you try and make meaning of it and try and help other people through as well. And that's certainly what she did until her last day on earth. She was just a very loving and kind person. And, you know, toward the end of her life, Fritz just amazed me with his dedication to her.
Did she ever share any campaign stories? Anything that you remember? Do you have a favorite? Did she have a favorite?
One of the interesting stories that, you know, I would think about that really was just the most poignant was when Paul Wellstone, for whom I used to work, was killed in a plane crash the week before the election in 2002. He was in a tight race. The Minnesota Democratic Party, the DFL party, asked Fritz if he would step in, come out of retirement and step in and take Wellstone's spot on the ballot. And he and Joan both, you know, they were retired. They were enjoying living their life. And Aunt Joan was a very avid potter, and she enjoyed making pottery. And just had a really nice life, very involved in the arts in Minnesota. But without even hesitation, the two of them together, I mean, it's not the kind of decision he would have made without her, but the two of them stepped in and, you know, basically started from scratch with 5 days left to go. And, you know, he didn't win, but, he fought the good fight. And that was very typical of both of them.
They lost a daughter, your cousin, to cancer in 2011. Obviously, that had to be devastating to the family. How is Walter Mondale holding up?
I think Eleanor's death in 2011 was a real blow, obviously, for them, for all of us who knew and loved her. She was such a presence and a personality in Minnesota, extremely well known. And she was also the light of their lives, and they fought her fight against cancer with her every day for 6 years. I think when Eleanor died, it took a piece out of both of them, and I think Joan's, health really deteriorated significantly after her loss, and Fritz is now, dealing with the loss of a daughter and a wife in less than 3 years, and he's holding up in a very typical Norwegian fashion, which is kind of stoic, but and strong, but he's certainly struggling with a lot of grief.
Please send him our and the nation's prayers and thoughts.
I will. Thank you.
Lucy Mondale is the niece of Walter and Joan Mondale. She'll be in Minneapolis on Saturday for Joan's funeral. Lucy, I'm sorry for your loss. Thank you so much for sharing your memories with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. To sign up for our weekly newsletter and to check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles, you can visit us on the web at kenrudinpolitics.com. Don't forget to send your comments, questions, and cash to ken@kenrudinpolitics.com. You can also follow me on Twitter @KenRudin and on Facebook. Our producer is A.D. Quigg. Kristen Sorensen is our associate producer, and Douglas Bell is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.